And welcome back to another episode of Masked Monologues. I'm your host, A Girl. Today I have with me Matt Betts, who is a science fiction horror author, and he states a speculative poet. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, how long you've been doing it for, and what inspired you to start?
Sure. I started writing way back in high school a billion years ago, and it was just a fun thing for me. I loved science fiction and horror all my life, especially when I was little. And my family, a lot of my family, my dad mostly, my grandpa, my aunt, they were all huge readers. And they would go through books like nothing, especially my grandpa just had these huge stacks of paperbacks of whatever. He had no genre that he loved. But so I was surrounded by people that read a lot, and I had a great imagination from science fiction, and it just sort of, it took me a while to really latch on to doing it, but it made sense for me to write stories. And my mother kept something I wrote really early on, and it was very clearly a Scooby-Doo ripoff. Mm-hmm. So you write what you know. And after that, I started ripping off Stephen King and things like that. But yeah, it just was, I enjoyed doing it. It's something, mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, it was releases where mm-hmm. if you sit down and just start doing things, doing this release of creativity. And so I eventually started writing short stories and poetry, and eventually started working on novels. And it just felt like something I should be doing.
You speak about ripping off other artists, and I just wanted to draw attention to this point that you made. There's this quote called, I think, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And right. The quote basically says that you have to draw from these inspirations, other artists, in order to create something unique, truly your own. Would you say that by reading all these authors, these books that these authors publish, you gained a better understanding of what truly resonated with you, what your writing was all about?
Right. Yeah, I absolutely. And that's been something I read everything I get my hands on for a while there. And I've slowed down because I'm so busy at this point. But when I was in college and high school, I just couldn't stop reading. And that's a point that I make because I also teach writing. I teach kids writing here in Columbus, and I teach adults at various workshops and things. That's the first thing when they ask, how do I become a writer? I say, read. You know, you got to mm-hmm. know what came before you and how something is written. Even if you want to subvert that and do something new and not with the norm, you've got to know how it was done before you can say, hey, I'm going to do it a different way. And that comes from going to the library and checking out a stack of books and reading them and going back and getting another stack, or reading in genres that you don't necessarily, or that don't appeal to you, just to see why they're popular to other people. That's helped me. Why does somebody read this type of book, or why is this book so popular? But mm-hmm. you know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, that's a terrible book, and it's very popular. People with the Twilight series and things like that, or Shades, everybody's, oh, I would never read that. And yet those books sold millions. So checking them out to see why people are reading them or what appeals to them, it makes sense. That's always my best advice to writers, is read mm-hmm. read everything you can.
Yes. And you said that you teach children. May I ask, is it more academic writing or creative writing?
No, it's creative writing. There's a terrific resource here in Columbus, and I'll absolutely plug them. They're the Thurber House, which is named after James Thurber, and mm-hmm. it's actually, part of it takes place in his house here in Columbus, his childhood home. And they have a center next to it, the Thurber Center, where they teach adults and kids, but they have these great summer camps. Kids can come and every day for a week, and they learn different things. They'll have a fiction class. They opt into a poetry class, and mm-hmm. it's much more creative than it is academic. We have one of my friends that was in a writing group with me. She teaches, and a lot of times they dress up as, they cosplay as whatever they're teaching, or they're talking about historical fiction or whatever. So it's very much an area to let kids really work on their creative skills, but it's also talking about, here's the structure within a poem, or here's the arc of a book, but here's how you take those great ideas you have and put them in place to make a good story, or to make mm-hmm. a valid poem, or even nonfiction. It's yep. a terrific resource. Yeah.
Can you explain some of those strategies or tactics you'd use to take this creative idea? Maybe it's somewhat vague, maybe it's a little elusive out there, a bit mysterious, you can't get a handle on it, and turn it into a story. Would you suggest maybe writing bullet points of what you want the plot of your story to look like? Or how would you suggest a writer, how would you approach that?
Yeah. I also, right now, my job, my day job, if you want to call it that, is teaching, helping writers at this company get their books started. And it's mostly nonfiction there, but it's some of the same ideas with nonfiction and fiction to get them going and to structure things. It's finding those main points. Like you said, maybe bullet points. I do a lot of whiteboards with brainstorming, just connecting ideas and just riffing on your main idea or your character. And what I do when I write, and I one of the classes I taught for a while with the kids to do the same, was I will take a character and I will go online and find somebody that looks like that character, sort of. It's not like exact, but an actor that might be in a role, and that maybe that role is more toward it. And I start making, we call it a book Bible or whatever, but I'll go through and find locations online that are, oh, this is similar to where I think my book would take place. And I encourage them to do that, whether it's going online and doing it or drawing their place or drawing their characters. And so I start there. And I also did another exercise that was like, what is your, it was from those old commercials, what's in your wallet, that credit card. But I talk about what characters they're carrying. What does your character have with them and why do they have it? Is it a picture of a family member? Is it a picture of a lost pet? Or do they have a lot of cash? Do they have no cash? What do they carry? And what does that tell you about the character? And kind of expand it from there. But the plot is always, you know, sometimes the tougher part, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And man, and I, for the longest time, with that old argument of plotter versus pantser, I was like a pantser for the longest time. I would just sit down and write and go. If kids want to do it that way, or writers want to do it that way, it's great. But I encourage them to have some sort of structure. It's fun to sit there and discover it and keep going. But my first couple of books took forever to write just because I had no goal. I had no end game for those characters. And so it took forever to figure it out. So I like to storyboard things, whether it's like taking index cards and writing the characters' names and putting them on the wall or putting them on a whiteboard, just to take one of those characters, whether it's your main character or it could even be an ancillary character, and kind of map out their journey if you can, even in the most broadest terms, what's the end result or whatever. And that's one way for me that I suggest they go about it, is just visualizing it, whether it's through pictures or whether it's through drawings. But yeah, no, there's a lot of ways to go about it. And I think that's the best place to start, is to know your characters, and it's a cliche, but know your character, what they want, what do they and what's going to stop them. And then you build out from there. Even when I really outline a story, I will go in and write sometimes the middle first, or once I wrote the ending first and then wrote the beginning and then wrote the middle. There's a scene that sticks in my head. I'll go in and write that. And that way I know what's happening at that point in the story. Mm-hmm. And so obviously if a character isn't there by then, something has happened, they've left or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of writing your story out of order if there's something you feel very strongly about in that story. I encourage them to new writers to do what feels right to them. But make sure they have a plan of how it's going to go, how it's going to end, who's going to be on the journey. Everybody has different advice.
Now, with that, I want to ask about the books you've previously written. Can you tell me if you took inspiration from your everyday life? Did you draw from people that you've seen or encountered with in your day-to-day life, daily basis, and incorporate elements of their character into your characters in your book? Or was it just mainly seeing what other authors had written and drawing from?
Yeah, there are a couple of instances I can give you those stories of where I absolutely pulled from real life or pulled from my own life in one way or another. The first book I wrote was took place during the Civil War, was a steampunk novel, and I got to write a sequel to that. And it took place during the Civil War in California, and my dad's sort of our family historian, and he had some records of our family from the Civil War. So I took inspiration from that particular family member, the things he went through, the unit he was in, I incorporated into the book, at least by name. So it was fun to do that. And one of the people in the book was a friend of mine, a name only. He was a friend of mine at work. It was nothing like his character. And he keeps saying he's going to write a book to get me back for what happened to that character, but it has his name and he hasn't done it yet. So I'm happy there. But it was a fun thing to put a friend into it. And it was also, it gave me sort of a touchstone. I did have a picture that looked nothing like my friend for that character. But so I used that in that first book because I was really struggling. It was like I said, my first book took forever to write, and to have those things and to have people encourage me. And I said, hey, I put you in this book. They kept coming back saying, are you done with that book yet that you put me in? Are you done with it? So they nudged me to keep going and keep sending it out there. Mm-hmm. And then subconsciously, the last book I put out was called, am I forgetting it already? I just put it out and I forgot the name of my book. But I had I wrote it, and the main plot, it was called Gone Where the Goblins Go. Good Lord, it's right here next to me. But I wrote it and I felt like it was really lacking this sort of emotional touch. And I really want to sort of out the this character's dad. I wanted to make their relationship a little different, a little better. It was just out there. And so a good friend of mine, when I was in college, I used to go with his family to the beach. They took me when we were on spring break or summer break, or whatever, they would take me to Myrtle Beach. And they loved going to the beach and flying kites. And so it came to me and I said, I'm going to figure out, somehow I'm going to work that in here, that this the dad loves flying kites. And what was funny is I just put it in there as this character trait. He moves to Japan long before our story starts, just to learn to make traditional Japanese kites and things like that. And so I thought that was fun. But then as I went through revising the book after that and more, and it became a big part of the book. It became an important plot point of the book, that just kites in general. And I didn't really realize it at the time, how much it was working in and how much I owed to that situation, and owed to that experience of being with that family, how it affected the book. And it made that book work for me. I mean, that hopefully makes the book work for everybody, but that plot point was so important. I just started by, I was just going to use it as a throwaway thing, and it became much bigger, but it wasn't consciously. By the time I got to the end, I'm like, oh my gosh, look at what that started and became. So yeah, I use it a lot. There are a few books I can look back and go, man, how did I work something into that? What was that have to do with my personal life? And maybe I can't really think of it, but I know poetry obviously is very personal, and I use a lot of my personal life. I wrote this poem called The Night Godzilla Dumped His Chick, which was renamed by the editor as Godzilla's Better Half, but it was very much a rumination on, it was all about God, and actually was nominated for awards. It's been a lot of different anthologies. It was just me loving Godzilla for one thing, but watching my son at the time was very little, and we would set up blocks all around the house for him to learn to crawl. Yes. And he refused to go anywhere until he got to knock all the blocks that we set up down. He was very angry if there was blocks standing up. So I took that personal experience and morphed it in with Godzilla always destroying Tokyo or another city. And it became a very personal poem again, without me meaning to. And like I said, a lot of people seem to enjoy it. And it was just something that I was just looking at my son and looking at Godzilla. Just a really weird combination. There were some other things that influenced it too that were very personal. But man, it just happens. It just comes out of nowhere. And you think, oh, that might be important, or that might be something that people can relate to somehow. So yeah, I love when that happens. Unfortunately, it doesn't always, but I love when it does.
No, that's wonderful. I want to go back to that point you made, how the first book you wrote took you forever. And I'm just wondering what motivates you to finish a book once you started, especially, I don't know if you're a self-published author, but for self-published authors out there, they don't exactly have a deadline, or they have a team to work with who expects it by this certain deadline. So I'm just wondering, once you start a book, what pulls you through all those pages? It can be 300 pages, 250 pages, 400 pages. Once you start, some people might get to page 30 and think, oh, this is stupid. I don't know why I'm doing this. So what motivated you to finish your books? And what would you say to authors who might need some encouragement?
Yeah, to try and make a long story short about my first book, I struggled with it. And I didn't have any formal training in writing other than going to college and taking some creative writing classes. I don't think I took that. I took mainly just English classes. And so I had this idea. And again, like I said, I didn't really have it formed out. So I was taking those small victories and thinking they were big victories. I was thinking, I would sit down and I would write a few paragraphs and think, okay, that's awesome. I've made some progress. And then I wouldn't touch the book again for months. And then I come back and go, aha, another paragraph. Woohoo, I'm cruising now. And it took me a year. So that first book, kind of like I was saying, that was the one where I put a couple of friends' names in it. And they were asking, hey, where's that book at? And where are you going? I finished it up and I started shopping it around to agents. Mm-hmm. And I was getting those good rejections from agents where they actually say, oh, this is great. It's a near miss. Mm-hmm. And I got one terrific rejection from an agent who said, I'm not going to take this on, but here's what I liked and didn't like, and actually gave me this great rundown of my book that I actionable items I could go in and fix. And so I went in and I was working on that. And I had met one of my dear friends still today. I'd met her and her husband at a conference, and we talked about poetry, and she got me excited about science fiction poetry. Mm-hmm. And years later, we kept in contact, but years later, she comes back and starts asking me questions about that book that, like I said, I finished and got some good feedback on, asking me how it was and where it was at and what. I found out that she was the editor for a new line of sci-fi, basically, and wanted to take a look at this book to include in their first launch, their big launch. And so she read it and said it was terrific, and I ended up lucky that they took me on. So I got a contract with that small publisher, and it went so well for them that they gave me a contract for more books. And so for a while, that first book came out in 2013. So for quite a while, I had deadlines built in. I was lucky to have deadlines, or at least I could say, hey, I'm going to have this ready by November of whatever. So we put out basically a book a year through them, which was terrific.
Yes.
And then I actually stumbled into another contract where I got two more books from a different publisher. And so they gave me deadlines. Hey, I'd like to see it by then. So I learned to be disciplined about it. But then after those contracts were done, I had to go back to doing things my own way and my own pace if I expected anything to get done. The next book ended up being for the Edgar Rice Burroughs people. And they had a deadline in mind. They were like, we want to get this new series launched by this date. Yes. And it was a pretty serious deadline for me. In fact, I took on a writing coach. I went to a writing coach and said, hey, I need help making sure I meet these deadlines and these guideposts. So that was the first time I ever really worked with a writing coach and working out how to keep myself motivated and how to stay on track rather than for a long time, I measured like a lot of people do in daily word count. And she encouraged me to work in weekly word counts. So that way, if I miss one of those counts in a day, I don't beat myself up and say, oh man, I missed it. And get super discouraged. That way, if I missed it, I know I could make it by the end of the week. Sure, I'm sure today, but I can make that 500 up somewhere during the week so that I end up with 10,000 at the end of the week or whatever it was. So it's tough to keep yourself motivated when you don't have a contract. My last one I wrote, Gone Where the Goblins Go, was one that I was writing. I loved the story. And so I was writing it, but I sort of imposed a deadline on myself and said, look, here's your self-imposed deadline. It meant nothing to anybody else. Except me, I just wanted to make sure I had it done, at least the first draft by a certain point. And I used that same method for that book of a weekly deadline. And after that, working on edits and second revisions and all that fun stuff. But man, staying motivated when you don't have that, or when you're self-publishing. I'm working on another poetry collection now, and I also self-published a novella just to see how it was. And really keeping yourself going, it's tough when you don't have that contract in hand, or you don't know where this is going to end up. I always encourage people to work toward a deadline like you have an agent, or you have an editor or a publisher. Because if you don't, you just don't have that impetus. You don't have that pressure. And you don't want too much pressure on yourself. But if you don't have some sort of pressure, whether it's self-imposed or not, you can say, I'll work on it next week, or I'll get started, or I'll have it finished by the beginning of next year rather than this year. It's tough. Accountability buddies are great, whether you're working with somebody else that has a novel at the same time. I have a terrific friend of mine named Mercedes, and we, for whatever reason, out of the blue, we were friends of somebody else. And I think she challenged me originally, just we're Facebook friends. And she said, I bet I'll finish this book before you, or I'll get accepted into the Horror Writers Association before you, or whatever. And so we, having that challenge, or having somebody to say, all right, here's how far I am, or here's how close I am to that goal, really pushed me to say, oh, you're not going to get there before me. And so having that buddy, whether it's an online critique partner or critique group, I ran a critique group here in Columbus for years, and they're still running, which is great. They're in like their 24th year at this point. But to have all those people be accountability buddies and say, okay, next week I'm going to bring a chapter of my book in for everybody to critique, having that pressure or having that goal kept me moving and kept everybody moving there, I think. So, you know, those are two of my big ones, having an accountability buddy and setting your own goals.
So this last point I want to discuss is about structured criticism. So you said once you were approaching agents and publishers, you got a multitude of rejections at first. I don't know how many rejections you got, but I believe that the best thing you can draw from rejection is that structured criticism, where it's like, these parts of your writing are amazing, they're excellent, they're up to par, although you could improve these aspects of your book. And for creatives, for authors, for artists, whatever, it's just applying that criticism and taking it in, but instead of projecting it inwards and thinking, oh, I'm a terrible author, I'll never make it, and looking at it objectively, how would you go about facing rejection, and can you relate this back to your personal experience?
Yeah. My first real experience with writing rejection. I was in college and I wrote this sort of horror poem that I loved, and I sent it off somewhere and it got rejected. And I thought, well, that piece got rejected, then I'm just a terrible writer. And I stopped submitting things, stopped writing for several years, just because as a teen, or I guess I was in my 20s by then, I thought that was it. If one person doesn't like your writing, they're probably right. All of your work is going to suck and everyone's going to hate it. So it's tough, especially those early rejections. And even once I got that first novel published, to see some occasional reviews. Luckily, most of my reviews were very good for that book. I was thrilled with that. But every once in a while, you'll see that review that says, you'll have 30 reviews that love it. And then you'll have that one that says, oh, this was tired plot and he stole this from them. And that's the one that sticks with you. You'll forget the 30 or 29 awesome reviews and that one that says, man, this character was a mild criticism that stays with you, especially, like I said, early on. For things like that, for reviews and criticism, things like that, I've stopped looking at reviews as much as possible or people on Amazon or whatever. I stay away from them because exactly for that point is that it can be very deflating when you're in a good spot. But as far as taking criticism from like a critique group or taking it from a critique partner or even getting that feedback from agents or publishers, it is tough because that's your baby. That's your book that you spent a year, 2 years, whatever. In my case, one of them was almost 3 years working on. So you know better than they do about your characters, right? You know about your plot better than they do. But man, it is that second set of eyes. And first of all, you don't have to accept anybody's criticism. But if you hear the same thing from two or three or four people, maybe that's a problem. Maybe that one thing is a problem. I had a lot of beta readers for my books, terrific people that love sci-fi and have absolutely no interest in seeing me fail, that if three of them come back and say, you rushed this part or this really didn't ring true to me. If I get that from more than one person, that's when I start focusing in. And other things, if I only hear it one or two times, I can really look at that now, having that experience of publishing several books, having 8 books out now and stories and everything else. I can take that with a grain of salt and not be, I still am a little hurt by it. As the author, I'm like, really? You didn't like that character? That's my favorite.
Yeah.
But you have to learn to have the right people looking at your work that are really in it with you, whether it's a really good friend, probably not your family. They're never really good critics.
Nope.
But people that you really trust or like their reading. Maybe they read a lot of the same books you do or into the same stuff you are. Surround yourself with those kind of people, whether they're good friends or people you find online in various clubs or whatever. If you trust their opinion, you trust their reading, have them look at it and know that they're hopefully trying to make it better for you. That's where I've gotten to. I can, at this point, like I said, I can take just about any criticism, but to have people that love my work anyway, or at least they've said they love it, give me good feedback or give me bad feedback, either way, that's really helped me figure everything out and keep going.
Okay. So I know I said that was the last, but I just want to ask you this one question, and it relates to AI. So I know everyone these days seems to be using AI technologies, ChatGPT, writing softwares to help them assist write books or whatever they're writing. How do you feel about AI and what are your personal perspectives on it? Do you integrate it into your writing or do you like to abstain from using it?
I was just talking about this the other day, and I'll tell you about the poetry I'm writing about AI here in a minute, but I'm against it. Obviously I'd rather have real people telling real stories. The other thing that comes to my mind is I think probably in 20 or 30 years, people will, their minds may change on that. Because there's so many things that we said, oh, this is terrible, this is a horrible invention or horrible, and it's actually come to end up helping us. But for AI, it just feels like it's using other people's creativity to make something new, whether it's really feeling creative or not. Especially with artwork, I really don't see the point in using an AI, other than the fact that it's easy to do, using AI for your covers or for your inside work. And absolutely writing stories, it just feels like they're cobbling together other ideas, but who knows what happens when it gets better at it or whatever, how we'll feel about it. But there's just something about a person, like we were talking about earlier, having these experiences and knowing these people and working their ideas and their quirks into a book, or somebody you grew up with and you can take their name just for fun and make a character out of it. Just those personal touches feel like you're never going to see that out of AI.
Yes.
I have used AI in the last book and in some ideas I'm working now. I used it to, like I said, I use pictures of people. I'll use AI and say, make a picture of a character that looks like this, and they're on a spaceship or whatever. And so I've used it to do character sketches, basically, so I can look off them. And when I'm writing their parts, I'll have that in front of me. I really haven't done anything else with it. I really don't want to. I think that's my own personal use, and I'm not throwing it out there forever. Excuse me, for everybody to see. And I'm not, hopefully not training AI to do something that I don't want it to, but I just feel like it's wildly impersonal. And I see people that are like, oh, I wrote a short story with ChatGPT or whatever, and they're trying to sell it. And so many editors can spot an AI story immediately. Yes. So I hate to say AI is horrible because it does have its functions, but man, for creative pursuits, I really feel like it's just not worth it to try and check that stuff out. Like I said, I have a weird poetry that I started writing for this new collection where they train AI by looking at other people's artwork and all these things. So I started writing these poems that are called aphrastic poems, where you're describing a genuine piece of art, like you're looking at the Mona Lisa, and as a poet, you're describing this. And so I started doing that, only I'm writing, describing that painting as if I'm the AI and analyzing it by, because AI is famous for putting too many fingers in or too many arms in. So I'm like looking at things like the Mona Lisa and saying, why doesn't it have more fingers? And looking at it from, and getting off those sort of internet tangents that things done through AI can kind of get off on weird tangents. So I'm not using AI, but I'm pretending I'm AI to write creative poetry. I've had a lot of fun with that, but actual use of it, I would never do that for a poem or for a story. Have you had occasion to use it? Do you know anybody that does?
I have personally tested it out, but I've found that the writing that's come out of it is not personal, and it has this algorithm or this code where you can plug in a prompt and you'll get something similar out that you got if you plugged in a previous prompt, especially for poetry, because one of my friends suggested, hey, why don't you use it to help you write your poems? And I'm also a singer-songwriter and musician, so I was plugging it in and seeing how will this work, because especially when it comes to music, you need that meter, that melody, that rhyme. And I found that a lot of the poems or whatever it was spitting out just wasn't up to the quality that I would like for myself and put my name on it, or just be tied to it, because it's not as personal as you say. And there's almost this eloquent sort of formal tone that it uses, as opposed to the more personal first person language that I usually use. So it just didn't relate to what I was doing stylistically.
Okay. So it lacks that sort of personal and human tone that people go for. It may be technically correct, but it may not have anything beneath or
with it. It's dull.
Yeah. My son plays a lot of video games. I've heard that he has found YouTube creators use whatever AI somehow, ChatGPT or whatever, to make their theme songs or something, to have just the music underneath it. So it just has a sort of baseless sort of rhythm or whatever, just to be an intro or something. But he said he's never heard anybody actually use lyrics with their intros. I think that makes sense. It can give you a technically good performance of music, but nothing beyond that, I think. Yeah.
Yes. And I believe that especially if you're singing the song, you have to have this connection to the lyrics in order to evoke the emotions that the lyrics are presenting or portraying to the world. And it's missing that personal touch.
Yeah, I'm trying to do voiceovers for books, do audiobook narration, things like that. And the groups I've joined online, or the different programs I've joined, are always after, they'll post things that are available, but they're always after people to come, and they'll pay you to give your voice to train AI to do audio narration. And I know some people that go for it. I've heard it's pretty lucrative for them to sell their voice, but on down the road, they've sold it to these people, and these people can then use it for anything. So I feel weird about even thinking about that, what someone would do with my voice in 20 or 30 or 40 years.
I know.
I wouldn't get paid for it. They'll pay me now and that's it. It's everyone else's from there. So it's weird that way.
Yes. No, I completely understand what you're saying. Just in terms of ethics, you don't know who's going to use it, what you're going to end up saying.
Can they use it in political ads that you may not agree with? Can they use it in whatever commercials that you may not endorse the product, but their voice?
Yes. No, that was a wonderful podcast. I'd like to wrap up now. So if you want to shout out to your social media channels or your website, if you have one, where can people find you, your books, and what you are all about?
Sure. You can go to my website, which is Mattbet.com. That's M-A-T-B-E-T. And you can use, I'm more active on Facebook and Instagram, or I believe on Instagram, it's Matt_Betts or Matt Betts Author, I think. But you can find everything from my website to connect to. And most of my books are available on Amazon. They're also available through the individual publishers like Dogstar Books and Severed Press out of Australia. They have some great ones. And Edgar Rice Burroughs, people have one of my favorite books out from them. You can find me on all those sites, and you can find me on fun podcasts. This one every once in a while. Just do a little Google search of Matt Betts and those should come up.
Okay. Thank you so much. And if you listeners like this podcast episode and you want more episodes like this, please share it with a friend or family member. Thank you.